Is the game of life a role-playing game?
I don't think it really is, because it's not like you have a character that you develop.
You have a little stick.
You have a little stick that goes in the car.
That's either blue or pink, and it goes in a car, and it's joined by other smaller sticks.
I think that that game would not really go this day and age.
It totally exists still.
Oh, yeah. But like, what if you're like trans and like you like, do you have to like pick pink or do you pick blue? Or I mean, is there like a purple choice? Like what is?
Or a gray. Yeah, I know. I don't think they've reached that, but I'm sure that custom pieces exist so you can play it that way if you want.
Sure.
Board games, like especially for kids, are so different now because I think the main base version of Monopoly still has money.
Oh, yeah.
But there is a easily available and not much more expensive one that you get a credit card, basically, and you stick it in the bank, and it's got a readout that tells you.
That seems like cheating. Just saying. It seems like cheating. Part of doing Monopoly is the math.
I don't disagree.
Yes.
I don't disagree. But, you know, you don't churn butter anymore. You go get it from the Indian
land of Lakes Grill. I understand. I don't use a lot of cash in my everyday life. I'm more likely to use a credit card. But the whole point of Monopoly is to see the money in your freaking hands and that you trade it with a bank. And yeah, anyways. Do you have to, in that new version where you have credit cards, do you have to go to the bank and ask for a loan and like sign something?
Possibly. You kind of do that already because you mortgage properties and you kind of sign things off. You don't like sign anything. I suppose if you got real serious, like if you were going to LARP like a game of Monopoly, everybody's sitting down, top hats on. You would go the whole way, and then you would like, oh, so you want Madison Avenue. Oh, okay, well, I guess we'll have to sign on the dotted line here.
Right.
Don't read the fine print. It's always the same.
Right.
That's just, you know, that's not important. That sort of thing.
Why is there always, like, jail on a Monopoly board? Like, why is that there?
Yeah, because, like, real CEOs don't ever go there, so it's weird.
No kidding.
Yeah. Landowners and real estate guys don't actually go to jail.
No.
So... They can threaten to send other people to jail.
Yeah.
Is there a favorite character that you've ever played?
Role playing? That's a good question. Well, there was a game that you and I did like way back, and my character was a rogue, half elf, and her name was Grace DeCoupe, which if you do it backwards.
So that's cool if you explain it.
Coup de grace.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. but she was pretty deadly with her sneak attacks, and she had like a two-fisted crossbow at one point there. So she was a lot of fun to play because there was this one move that I had that was like called like go for the eyes, and I think I did that. I mean, that was a daily, so I couldn't do it all the time.
You shoot people in the eyes.
Yeah, but it was pretty fun.
I think if I remember correctly, because a lot of times in role-playing games, you can inflict conditions on your enemies in order to, you know, make them less effective. And so you could, like, maybe you had some gas that you could throw in somebody's face that blinds them. But this was just like, creature is blinded permanently.
Right.
Like, you have shot their eyes out.
Yes.
Ralphie style.
Yes. Pretty much.
So I thought that was kind of neat because it's like, all right, well, that's it.
Sorry.
that person's blind now.
This effect does not end.
Unless they have a regenerate spell or for their eyes or maybe.
Right.
I wonder if like a blindness deafness spell would remove blindness would even work on that.
Would
their eyes grow back? We never found out. You just shot out. It left a lot of shattered eye sockets in your wake.
I sure did. How about you, Cal? Any favorite characters?
Oh, I can't even.
Can you even pick? I mean, you've been playing like role-playing games for how many years
now? A while.
Yeah.
I don't want to tell anybody how long.
Most of your life.
I don't know. Don't talk about Star Trek. Probably the character that I played in a long-running Star Trek role-playing game.
You just broke your own rule.
Yeah, I know. It was from Last Unicorn Games, I think, was the last people to have that license. And
wow.
Well, I don't know. Who knows who names it? But the games were good, and it was a similar structure of game. It was a D6-based type thing.
Sure.
Which I always find to be more conducive to storytelling, because when you're rolling groups of D6s, it just you can't get a one.
Mm-hmm.
There's never going to be a one. Right. You can roll three ones if you roll three six-sided die. But it all, and so everything lands on a scale of relative success. So you want to hack a computer, mm-hmm. and you can roll 4d6 because you've got a 4 in your computer skill.
Sure.
So you roll the 4 six-sided die. Your result is 4 through 24. Now, the game master sets some number. Let's say 16 is where it's going to be.
Sure.
But you might get a 13. So maybe that is you have succeeded, but you have accidentally tripped some sort of like computer alarm
right.
that you don't know about because you missed it by that much.
Uh-huh.
Or you could get 24. You get 6 on all 4 die. You get 24 points, and you have greatly succeeded, and you've also now uncovered some other bit of information that, like,
sure.
the thing you were trying to hack, there's something else attached to it, or the door you're trying to open, you know, there's somebody behind it or something like that. And so the game master can set the conditions. And that way it isn't just, I want to do this. You roll, you fail, you fall off a cliff and die, game's over.
Right.
The game never really has to stop, necessarily. You just add complications, which leads to some of the best and most memorable situations that you find yourself in. Because as far as table talk goes, people always have stories about their favorite characters or the favorite situations that they were in. And it revolves around how bad things got. It's never just Klendor the Barbarian severed the dragon's head, saved the fair maiden, got all the gold, and he went home. Bad
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot more fun when Klendor's sword breaks on the dragon's hide, and the fair maiden turns out to be a shape-shifting witch in disguise.
Sure.
And the money was a treasure chest with a mouth that now wants to eat you.
Of course.
How are you going to get out of this?
Yeah.
So I didn't answer your question. It was a character from that. I had a friend of mine who ran a game, and it lasted literally for about 8 years.
Wow.
And we played it a lot when we were together in school, and then we all kind of went our separate ways, but a lot of us still lived around in town, so we'd get together periodically and sort of continue it. And the more time there was in between the times that we couldn't play, instead of just saying, freeze it right here.
Sure. Pick up.
Come back, pick it up right where it was. We would find a reasonable ending point. Then we would come back like a year later and say a year had passed, or maybe 5 years had passed.
Okay.
So we got to see our characters age. And in a Star Trek game, you are basically playing a Star Trek crew, like a crew of a ship or something.
Sure.
So it's that thing that you don't ever really get from the Star Trek shows that you watch, like Next Generation. We got to see our characters actually age
mm-hmm.
and actually move on past certain things. So we were all in one ship, and as years went on, we got our own commands. And then the next time we got together, it'd be a situation where our multiple ships have to work together to
sure.
solve some problem or fight some battle. And yeah, I think that was probably one of my favorite experiences.
Okay.
It's cool.
Yeah.
But it was Star Trek, so it wasn't cool.
Well, because Star Trek is never cool?
No. Well, we're not cool. That's why people are listening to this. We're the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Mika Nana.
And we were talking about role-playing games because we are talking about role-playing games
yes.
today. Role-playing game movies. Our Crafts to Services segment is, of course, impending on this Monday show. And we have decided to talk. We decided to watch.
Yes.
Now we are forcing ourselves to talk about.
Yes.
Dungeons & Dragons from the year 2000.
From the year 2000.
A film, yes, based on the popular pen and pencil role-playing game around since 1974?
Something like that.
Is the number that comes to my head. I'm not sure. I think that's probably right. And yeah, not a spoiler to say not a very good film, but we will pick apart why it is not a little later. And then almost as a side thought, I had a thought that we should try to find something that complements that choice. And we did in a film that is a documentary
yes.
about people who play role-playing games.
Yes.
And it's called The Dungeon Masters.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out a while ago in 2008? Seven, I believe.
Yeah.
And it chronicles the life of three specific kind of nerds, if you will, following them from, it starts with like a Gen Con in I think like 2006, and it basically runs for a year until 2007, and it follows their lives, the struggles they face, what it is they like about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They're all middle America nerds.
Yes.
Middle to lower middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And you think you know what it's going to be. You think you know that it's going to be, look at these nerds.
Right.
And I'm not saying that it's not that, but it ended up becoming a lot more than that.
I think so.
And I was excited to get a chance to watch it again. I saw it when it came out originally a long time ago, and we'll be talking about that as well. And, of course, we'll be doing a little news because got to get back to that news.
Yes.
There are some things to talk about. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Cal. I'm excited to be talking about these role-playing movies, even though there is a special place for the Dungeons and Dragons movie, I think. Like, I mean, maybe we could talk about this late in a little bit, yeah. but do you think that it is possible? I think it is possible for a good Dungeons and Dragons movie. This is not necessarily it, but I think that they could have made I think that there's a lot of source material there, and I think it's completely possible for there to be a good movie. I mean, would you agree with that, or do you think that it's too difficult a task?
I think that your problem, and maybe we should wait until we get to the segment, but I'll answer your question. The problem is that it's not art. Like, D&D isn't art.
Okay.
Because it's, and this is, now I'm actually with Roger Ebert on this one. It isn't art because there's self-involvement.
Okay.
Now, you perhaps combining with your friends, I don't know, maybe the end point, like a campaign,
sure,
with a guy who's writing it, with people who are pretending to be characters
and
who are creating their own contributions.
Yep.
Maybe that is a work of collaborative performance.
Sure.
Art. Especially if people are watching. How many crowds have you had watching your role-playing games? None. Ever. But ultimately, there's no story there. Now, sure, there are characters, there are settings and backgrounds. There's things like the world of the Forgotten Realms, or the world of the Dragon Knights of Kryn, or something like that. And there are plenty of books and extended media involved,
sure,
there. But what's the story that you take? The cool part of role-playing games is inserting yourself into it.
So you don't think that can be really depicted well in a film?
You can depict it, but who is this person that we're rooting for and why?
Yeah.
They lack the most identification you can get with a character in a story when you are that character.
Right.
So I don't know. Like, are all D&D books written in second person? No, they're not.
Right.
None of them are.
Do you think you could, like, do something somewhat like Labyrinth, like where, you know, like there's people who are playing a game and they get sucked into this world and then they have to actually play the game?
Like the Dungeons and Dragons Saturday morning cartoon show?
Yeah.
Maybe. What about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the community episode?
Yeah. Like that.
Okay. Well, the answer is yes. It happened.
Okay. All right.
You've seen it.
All right. I mean, I think that episode is really well done.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Although it finds a similar tack because you've got a character who is pathetic. Like, I'm not casting aspersions on him. Like, he is a pathetic character.
Yeah, I know.
And the whole thing is about the team or the study group trying to sort of rally his spirits,
yes,
and connect with him over this weird thing that he does. And then,
mm-hmm,
we milk the comedy out of it.
Yeah.
So I think it would have to be like that. Otherwise, it's just Fantasy X. And there's a lot of room for fantasy now with the success of The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
But nobody besides them have really seemed to nail things down. I mean, the Chinese love Warcraft, the movie, didn't do so hot over here.
No.
And you've got, you know, examples of other attempts to make fantasy more mainstream and not just Deathstalker, which I got nothing against. B-minus C movies like Deathstalker. or even Conan, which,
sure,
you know, was written by Oliver Stone, directed by John Milius, but still had a real solid B-movie sort of foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, and we blew our last segment. This was the last segment. But we've talked about it now. It's fine. We will return to this conversation,
yes,
later after the news. All right, something that I mentioned last week, and because we couldn't report on it. We couldn't,
that's right,
do it.
We didn't have enough time.
But we are going to do it now. J. Scott Campbell is an artist who has worked for a long time. He is most famous for founding, I think, or at least being a big part of Cliffhanger Studios.
Okay.
Who created works like Danger Girl and Danger Girl. That's about it.
Okay.
And was also a artist on Gen 13 for a long time. It's kind of where he got to start with Image Comics. I believe that's Wildstorm. And yeah, and here's what he does. He basically just does like covers and commissions and pinups now.
Okay.
Because he is like a booty guy, like a booty drawer.
All right.
He's like a white Frank Cho.
Alrighty.
Ooh, sorry, J. Scott. Sorry.
That's a...
I don't know how else to describe him. I mean, that's what he does. It's like, it's cheesecakey type stuff. And he is the guy who got in trouble recently for drawing a variant cover of Invincible Iron Man number 1 that,
okay,
featured the new character, Riri Williams.
right,
who is a young black woman, or a girl, 15-year-old girl, who has got her own armor. She's sort of taking over for Tony Stark as Iron Man or Iron Woman. And he got in trouble because people didn't, they thought it was over-sexualized.
It probably was, if the booty was popping. And she's supposed to be like a 15-year-old girl. That's not really cool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Reminds me of when Cho, like, did he draw Spider-Gwen, like, in a questionable position, or did he just threaten to?
No, his new thing is now he just does that to piss people off.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. I mean,
because he, yeah, I'm not sure if he did anything specific in terms of a cover or variant cover. But his new thing now is they sell variant covers for people who don't know. How do you not know? You're listening to the show.
Right.
There's the main cover that's like, this is the cover we've chosen. And then a lot of times, almost always now, Marvel will release extra editions of a specific book, especially if it's a number one or something special, where they've commissioned other artists to draw a picture in their right. own sort of interpretation. And a lot of those, sometimes there is a blank cover. It's just white, completely white.
Sure.
And the idea is that you take it to a con and you give it to your favorite artist and they do a sketch for you. And so Frank Cho made a habit out of drawing sexy stuff, She-Hulk's buttons popping off her blouse or something, and then Spider-Gwen would be in the corner like, stop it, that's not cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very mature.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just Cho mean troll.
Yeah.
Korean, that's what I want to know.
Oh, stop.
Anyway, so J. Scott Campbell drew another picture of Riri Williams, and he's calling it the Riri Rethink, and okay. it is very different than his original cover.
Okay.
It's actually very... I was talking to a friend of mine about this cover, and he and I aren't offended necessarily by what people are thinking of as the over-sexualization of this character.
Okay.
I don't think it looks that bad. It just looks sloppy. Like, this guy's been drawing for a long time. He should do better than this.
Right.
It looks cheap. And so I've seen this new one. It's called Riri, R-I-R-I, Rethink. And it is better. Like, just the work is better. It's clear that he took more time on it. He's eliminated these sexual elements. He's given the character, like, a pose and
sure.
sort of a look that is more reflective of what this young, like, woman is. She's a young inventor.
Right.
You know, and so it's a much better piece. Nobody commissioned it. It isn't a Valiant, It's not definitely not Valiant. It's not a variant cover. It's not going to be published anywhere as of yet that we know. He just did it, I think, because
it's
he
a reaction
felt
to...
he needed to redeem himself.
Huh.
Which is, Frank Cho cannot even, he just heard a high-pitched squeal
right.
as we said all that. He doesn't even understand
no.
what I just described. So I have to give it to Campbell for that. Are there commercial concerns? Clearly. Clearly. Clearly there are. I mean, he wants to work again.
Right.
And so let's not give him all the laurels just yet.
Right.
But the fact that he decided to do this, I think, is a real positive thing. And he has said, it's not, like I said, it's not going to be published anywhere. But he said, you know, people complained on social media. The first one got killed because of social media. This could perhaps
help him
be promoted.
Yes.
It could get published because of social media.
Yeah.
Audio wink, wink.
Right. I mean, just looking at the first cover that he did, it's not completely over-sexualized, but it's maybe a little over-sexualized for a 15-year-old character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's cool that he, kind of his own volition, obviously, he has his reasons for doing so. But,
yes, yes.
But he went ahead and he did it, and he put it out there. And so I do think that he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, I think it's cool. It's going to be a long road back for him, though. You should see the entire body of work, emphasis on the body that he has
okay.
Created and come to this point in time on. Anyway, DC, let's move to DC. DC TV shows, in a report by The Hollywood Reporter, are making over $1 billion a year in revenue for Time Warner.
Oh, wow.
Huge, huge properties. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, Batman vs. Superman made $873 million worldwide, which is a disappointment.
Yep.
Somehow.
Yep.
Suicide Squad made $745 million, which was completely, they didn't even expect that.
No.
And Captain America Civil War on the Marvel side has made $1.1 billion so far to date.
Wow.
And so that's all huge. And so the combined DC lineup of TV shows for CW and CBS for Supergirl, first season of Supergirl, Arrow, The Flash, Legend of Tomorrow, Supergirl, and iZombie have made this combined $1 billion.
That's pretty amazing.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's any sign of stopping.
No.
So.
No, it's never going to stop.
No.
I don't know what they're going to do when Arrow Guy goes, I don't want to be Arrow Guy anymore.
They'll have to...
it's got
to
happen at some point, right?
Yeah, they'll have to figure out a way for him to die or something. Maybe, like, his sister will take over. Who knows?
Well, okay, so don't really watch Arrow.
It's been
a while.
I
know that they've introduced, like, his son, Connor.
Okay.
Who is still, like, a kid. So they could flash forward a couple years and just say, oh, recast the kids, aren't kid.
Right.
And get a Grant Gustin type, you know?
Sure.
Who? Oh, actually, no, that's not going to work because his son is mixed race. So hopefully they'll make the right decision as far as that casting goes. Again, haven't really seen the show, so I don't know if the little kid is mixed race, but...
Right.
Balls in your court, Warner. Balls in your court. If J. Scott Campbell can learn how important it is to not piss off fans...
Yeah.
You guys got to know that, right?
I would hope so. I would definitely hope so. And they're doing so well, I think that the answer is yes.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Ghost in the Shell, the film, is still coming. It's set to come out on March 31st of 2017.
It's kind of a weird time slot.
It is a weird time slot, but I think it's a weird film. I think it's definitely going to give people the sort of action that they want, but it's going to be a tough sell, which is ironic because the property is over 30 years old, I think, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still going to be tough to sell to people, even with ScarJo. But landing in that sort of weird, and at this point, let's face it, March 31st is like pre-summer at this point.
Yes.
It could be set to get in and get some cash before Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever else comes sweeping in and just takes everything out. So we've heard a little more about the movie now. It's still a lot of the production's under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
And executive producer Michael Costigan was talking about some of the inspirations that are going to go into the film.
Okay.
He said that it's not going to be a direct adaptation of either the manga from 1989 or the popular 1995 animated film.
Okay.
It's going to be, he says, a, quote, portal into that universe, end quote.
What the heck does that mean?
I don't know. But he goes on to say, quote, we also drew inspiration from some more contemporary films as well.
Like what?
End
the
quote.
Matrix?
Now I will tell you. Producer Arian Whitefield added, Gods of Egypt.
What?
Avatar the Last Airbender.
Okay.
They were able to get a sneak preview of Doctor Strange, and that inspired them.
Okay.
And Whitefield continued to say that there were elements of drama and comedy, saying, quote, Aloha served as a great inspiration of mixing the two, end quote.
What? I feel really concerned now. I don't feel like I was this concerned before about this film. I mean, a little bit because, you know, people are really upset about the whitewashing.
That's what the story is about.
Oh,
that's
my
why
gosh.
I'm reporting this. Yes. You know that Emma Stone movie? They're using that as inspiration for their Ghost in the Shell film.
What Emma Stone movie?
Aloha.
What is Aloha? I don't know Aloha.
Cameron Crowe's movie.
Okay.
Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
And Emma Stone plays a Hawaiian woman. No. But, maybe the inspiration that they drew was how to whitewash actors.
Stop it.
Bam. So I don't even know.
Is this even going to be recognizable as Ghost in the Shell?
Even know anymore. Well, there is some actual somewhat good news. Avi Arad, the very famous producer who got Marvel Studios off the ground and then kind of got out of there before the big money came rolling in.
Mm.
And anyway, that's a whole other story. He is a producer on this as well, and he has talked to sources, and he said specifically that they are not going to do the Puppet Master storyline, which was the main storyline from the 1989 manga and from the film. And they won't be doing the Laughing Man storyline as well, which was kind of the main thrust of the television show.
Okay.
They're actually going to, he said that they're going to do a story that involves Kuze.
Okay.
And the Kuze story is a story from the 11th episode of the second season of the Ghost in the Shell TV show.
All right.
Why that is significant and what happens in that episode essentially, and this will be kind of spoilerish, I guess, for this episode of TV, is that Kusanagi finds, it tells this story about this young boy and this young girl who are both severely injured, like in an accident.
Sure.
And they get cyber bodies.
Sure.
And the girl's having trouble adjusting to hers. The boy gets one too. He eventually becomes a soldier and goes to war because in the past of Ghost in the Shell, it's sort of, it moves around when the year is, but it's kind of a World War III-ish situation.
Sure.
And so he goes away. She never finds out if he's alive or dead. And it ends with Kusanagi asking about like where this boy is or if he's still alive and not really finding out. And it's heavily implied that this is her story. This
that
is
she's
her origin.
As a little girl.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, throughout the show, they tell us that, you know, she's had her cyber body since she was a very young girl. They've never really told her origin story. So we've heard in other places that this is going to be an origin story, and
it sounds like it
is. It looks like that's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how do you feel about that?
I don't care.
Okay, you don't care. All
well,
right.
Actually, what I said origin story, and I should clarify before. They've actually said that it's not going to be an origin story. Now, when they bring up this episode and they say it's not going to be origin story, maybe they're one producer saying one thing, one saying another. But I think the implication is they're going to draw off of this story, this idea, this background, and then not have us just go through like we, oh, here's a little girl. First 20
emotions.
Minutes of the movie is her life. And yeah, maybe we'll get it in like flashbacks and things like that. And that's probably the way to do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I feel like there were some negative things and some positive things in that story. So, I guess we'll wait and see. I kind of want to see more of a trailer for that film too, because they gave us like, talk about teasers. Like there were like four or five like teasers that were just snippets.
There should be one incoming anytime, wouldn't you think?
I would think so.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's do one more story before we move on and talk about Dungeons and Dragons. Something that doesn't have any dragons, but I don't think they'd look out of place. Marvel's Doctor Strange has kicked the ass at the box office this weekend.
Yeah.
Right now it's projected at $85 million for its opening weekend.
Wow.
That is above the predicted $70 million.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's made it's made $325 million worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's been open for two weeks.
And
overseas.
Internationally, yes.
And its debut is on par with Thor the Dark World, pretty much ties it at $85 million. It did not top Iron Man or Guardians, which made $98 and $94 million respectively. But it did beat Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger, and Ant-Man.
Okay.
Ant-Man had a $57 million opening weekend and was called a modest success.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Ant-Man, they were expecting nothing.
Right.
Did okay. This, I don't think they really knew. I think that they raised those projections based on Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
But, yeah, this is just way more than they thought. So we're almost definitely looking at Doctor Strange 2 at some point in the future.
Okay. Well, I kind of look forward to seeing what they will do with that story.
Yeah, you can listen to our previous show for our review of Doctor Strange, the film. I hope they improve it, too.
Yeah.
They got a little ways to go.
Yeah, they do. I'd like to see a little bit more character development and...
For who?
Everybody.
Ha!
And I don't know, make Mordo a fully realized character and not just whatever you need him to be.
Oh, he's been realized. He's been realized for sure.
Yeah.
They were realizing left and right with that character.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I don't know. I was interested to see how like they would, you know, seeing Mordo and Strange together and kind of seeing how they would work together and wasn't really satisfied with what the film showed. So
there are specific scenes where they work together, but I just feel like there is so much going on, especially in the kaleidoscope battle. I don't know what you call it, where you're kind of following them. We kind of stick with Strange because he's our hero,
right?
And I think that Mordo ends up doing things kind of in the background. But if it treated him more like a co-protagonist, and not just the guy that hangs around. Because if you look at The Matrix, Morpheus does need to be saved by Neo.
Right.
But he's the mentor figure for a lot of it. Then he becomes the sort of dramatic irony patsy when Neo is learns when he learns.
Right.
Is it possible to spoil the Matrix at this point?
I don't
Let's not do
so.
It if we don't have to. And so suddenly our respect for this character, the magical, all right, he is a black guy. But I don't want to focus on that right now. Just the being the mentor, you know, this mystical
right.
mentor, the ancient one, sort of.
Right.
It's immediately flipped on its head because we know, oh, he has no idea what he's talking about. And he believes something so strongly. Now he looks like a big dummy.
Right.
But then he's totally validated later on when Neo accepts his teachings and just goes balls out to save him.
Right.
Yeah, and then, like, Mordo hangs around, I guess. He's just there.
He does, yeah. He's
you know what
there.
I mean? He's just there.
He's just there, and
they
we
don't
even see him doing
I
anything.
I know, and they so ambitiously, hell, welcome to part two of our Doctor Strange review. They took such a big step in trying to make him sympathetic.
Yes.
Because he's really only ever been, like, just
a
sniveling,
villain.
Yeah, selfish piece of crap in the comics.
Right.
And they didn't do the work necessary to solidify that, so.
They didn't at all, and that was
Let's hope
disappointing.
That Bateau has a lot to do in the Ghost in the Shell film.
Okay.
I don't even know who's playing him.
I don't either.
That's not going to be, isn't it Michael Pitt? Is it Michael Pitt in it?
I have no idea.
Oh, boy. That better not be him. So anyway, Doctor Strange, still in your movie theaters now. Go see it. And when you go see it, you can come back to our Twitter or our Facebook page and tell us how crazy we are or how right we are or what you would have done to fix the film, to tweak it a little bit.
Yeah.
I think there are tweak opportunities. There are tweak-tunities. For sure.
Tell by your eyes that you've probably been crying forever.
I always wondered if it was a singular joy for movie reviewers to come up with a clever title that really just bashes the hell out of the movie that they didn't like. Then I became a movie reviewer. It was like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely it is.
Absolutely what it is.
And it's a gift when they make it really, really easy for you, too.
Well, you had to work a little bit at Dungeons & Dragons because there's just Dungeons & Dragons. Should have left that dragon in the dungeon. See, it doesn't really work.
No.
Toronto Star says, there's no dice for D&D.
Wow.
Yeah, that's one of many bad reviews that led Dungeons & Dragons from the year 2000 to have a rating of 10% on Rotten Tomatoes. I think we did it.
Uh-huh.
I think this is the worst film that we've ever done, or at least worst rated.
Well, I think it's definitely the worst rated.
Yeah. I think that's 10 is it. We should have a meter for this. Our own tomato meter.
Like where we put the film.
Or
films.
Tomato. Maybe the tomato meter. And they go, you're infringing on us. It's tomato.
Not tomato.
It's tomato. That's got the whole thing off. Tell your lawyers to go home. So, yeah, it's Dungeons & Dragons. It is a film that is set in a world that is unrecognizable. There is no, you asked before, what would it be about? Here's what it's about. You just make a bunch of shit up off the top of your head.
Yep.
And that's what they did. It stars Justin Whalen. Don't worry about it. Actually, do, because I feel like his face was semi-recognizable in the 90s. He was Jimmy Olsen in Lois and Clark.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually probably about it.
Oh.
Like he's done some TV and stuff. I'm not sure if Dungeons & Dragons like killed him like as a star.
It certainly didn't help.
It certainly didn't help. No. There are some people who made it out of this one alive, like Marlon Wayans, though. Thora Birch is also in it.
Yeah.
I think this is the first movie that she made like after American Beauty.
Really? I mean, she's very, very young in this.
Yeah.
It just seems
American Beauty was 99. This is 2000. I'm not sure about when they were filmed exactly, but yeah, this is the next film for her that came out after that.
That's just surprising to me, but maybe. Do you think that they filmed this like before they filmed American Beauty, and then it just took a long time for it to come out?
Possibly. We can talk about the filming process of this in a second. Zoe McLellan plays a wizard in this. I don't know what you know her from. I think she's on NCIS or something like that. She's actually been on TV for a while now, and very famously, Jeremy Irons.
Yes,
is in this film.
Yes, he is.
Oh, Jeremy Irons.
Yeah. Yep.
He's a very good actor.
He is a very good actor.
And I wonder if there's a lot of pressure to be a very good actor. Do you think that Anthony Hopkins, after his subdued line readings and his clear intent but softly spoken, goes home and just kicks like a row of dogs, you know?
Or no.
Just goes home. The driver drops him off outside the beautiful building. The doorman says hello to him. He goes inside his luxury apartment, and every single piece of stick of furniture is smashed, and it's just broken glass and windows. And that guy's like, maybe he runs on rage. You know what I mean?
It'd be a
contrast to his professional outward life and appearance.
Well, it would be.
Jeremy Irons is awful in this film, but it's kind of like a beautiful awful. It's almost like my original point was he kind of gave himself like permission to just shotgun it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
He could have come in and went, because I feel like Bruce Payne is also in this. A character actor plays heavies a lot. He's the Damodar, the guy with the shaved head, the blue lips. Y'all got any more of those dice?
Yeah.
and he's trying.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's super intense, so much so that he's whispering every line.
And you're just like,
which doesn't matter when
God.
Every single line of dialogue is ADR'd in this.
It's
in fact, I think Jeremy Irons might be the only live guy like on the set. Like, I feel like he was actually speaking the things that he was screaming.
Yeah.
But Jeremy Irons, he don't care. He's Honey Badger.
Mm-hmm.
And he is being like wonderfully bad, almost as if like he's like, well, this is my only shot to be in. Like a James Whale monster movie, you know, like that level of histrionics. And he really delivers it. And he becomes, it's like a room, the room level of badness.
Yeah. That's really
what
well
I have to assume is a very self-aware performance.
Yes. I mean, because he is a very good actor.
Yeah. And if he had, this didn't make any Razzies. I don't think the Razzies even cared. It was nominated for some Stinker Awards, the Stinker Bad Movie Awards.
Okay. Never
but was not actually nominated for any Razzies. But if he had been nominated and won, I bet he would have showed up and been like, thank you.
Yeah.
That's it. Yes. That's exactly what I was
Somebody
trying
got
for.
Exactly yeah,
you,
what
you
I...
You got it. But not a lot of other people really got this film. It is set in the Empire of Izmir. It's an empire that is a... has very heavy, strong class divisions.
Yeah,
there are mages that are in charge of everything.
Yep, and there's a mage school.
Yes, and they are ruled over by Empress Savina, played by Thora Birch,
mm-hmm.
who is a young ruler, a very Amidala-esque sort of child ruler,
yep.
who seems to not have a lot of power because of her position and being shut out by this council of wizards. In comes Profion, played by Jeremy Irons, who is a scheming mage.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to create a scepter to control dragons.
Yep.
Because this is a world of dragons.
Yes.
And if he has control of the dragons, he can wrest power away from the Child Queen. Although, why not just, like, send Blue Lips to kill her in her sleep or something?
Apparently, then we wouldn't have a movie. So.
Yeah, well, exactly. There wouldn't be a movie. And so that's the sort of political Coruscant storyline that's going on in the background, of which... some of the best looking sets in the movie, because this was filmed in Prague, in Czechoslovakia.
Yes.
And so, of course, or at least these parts were. Every other part of the film looks like a mid-budget Renaissance fair.
Yeah.
But a lot of these scenes.
CGI'd.
Or it's just straight CGI. But a lot of these scenes were filmed like, you know, the scene in the castle, the broken down castle, that's a real castle. The Council of Wizards, that's an actual like theater or something like that in Prague.
Okay.
And so. They stretch their $45 million budget as far as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Movie only made $33
million. Oh,
not a success.
No.
Enter our heroes Ridley and Snails, played by Justin Whalen and Marlon Wayans.
Yes.
Separately, who are thieves. But if you want to play the D&D game,
Rose.
I would say they... Well, okay, I guess if it's third edition. But they... Ridley's multi-classed for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
He's got a little fighter thief. He's like a brute build
sure.
of a thief, a rogue. And he might have a leveler sorcerer or two.
You think so?
It is suggested that he has a magical talent.
Okay. Like raw magical talent.
Sure. He's able to interact with the magical map and all that.
That's true.
And his father used to read
maps or something.
Runes or something. He knows runes or something like that. Anyway, yeah. So they decide that because the wizards don't care and they want to live free, they're real hukuna matata-y, They are going to rob the Council of Wizards. They're going to break into their tower and rob them.
Because that's a good idea.
Oh, sure. Of course it is. You always want to rob the mage school. First thing you do. While they're there, they sneak in and they are caught by Marina, played by Zoe McLellan, who is a young wizard apprentice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. D&D, I think it was Wizards at the time that owned D&D, still does, wrote or released stats for all the characters in the film.
Of course they did.
So Ridley, Snails, and Marina are third level.
Okay.
Which explains a lot. Explains why Marina casts maybe like one or two spells.
Yeah.
In the entire film.
She has a couple of dailies and...
Oh, okay. Well, you're going fourth edition.
I'm sorry.
Wow. That would make this 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, I think. No, I just figured like when she was in... And then there's like magic powder, which is not really a thing, but apparently that lets you cast extra spells. But I figured she just casts a lot of spells in the beginning. She probably has like a lot of high level magic items, like with charges.
Yes.
And then once they steal this map and they... flee the tower.
Yes.
The thieves with her in tow because Damodar has come to the tower to get this map. The idea is that Profion wants... He's tried to make this rod to control gold dragons on his own. It doesn't work. And he knows about this fabled other rod that can control red dragons.
Right.
And there's a map to find it. And so he sends Damodar and his death knights, his guard, to go get the map from this old wizard that lives in the tower.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, our thieves have the map.
Yep.
And so they run out of there, and then she gets pulled along with them, and it all kind of goes from there.
And then they meet a dwarf
who's
a fighter.
They fall out of a dimension door, and they meet a dwarf completely randomly, who we don't learn until the credits is named Elwood.
Yeah.
And they all go, and then the rest of the thing is just pretty academic. Like, they go to your bog standard D&D tavern, where they get in a fight and they have to get out of there.
Yep.
They learn that they have to get this gem called like the Heart of the Dragon, which is like this giant like fist sized ruby.
Right.
And so they do that. To do that, they have to go to this thieves guild that's in another town.
Yep.
Where they meet a guy named Zillis who owns it or runs it, played by Richard O'Brien, who of course was the original Riff Raff in Rocky Horror.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. I can see that. Yep.
And he also, this is an in-joke that I did not get being American, but he hosted a like a game show called The Crystal Maze.
Oh.
And so the fact that there is a maze in the Thieves Guild is a reference to that, I guess.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And it's very labyrinthy.
Yes.
It's
it's very like Canadian TV show level of effects and budget, because now Ridley has to go in. This Heart of the Dragon is the prize at the center of the labyrinth in the Thieves Guild, because every Thieves Guild has a labyrinth.
Of course.
Yeah, of course it does.
Everybody knows that.
Just ask the three-eyed purple guy, who is definitely a something.
I have no idea.
There are dragons and beholders in this film, and that's about it as far as any kind of real D&D
like monsters
things go.
Yeah. I know. And then they throw a bunch of like other like looking creatures in there that somebody had to come up with, you know, do drawings for makeup.
Yeah, just a green man.
We have no idea who they are.
Nope.
There's no thematic weight to them being there. Not explained.
So they go. He goes through this sort of test of trials that is, like we said, cheap, but I thought it was fun.
It was fun.
Probably one of the funnest parts of the movie. He just has to get through all these death traps in what is definitely a concession to a dungeon crawl.
Yes.
They're just not in a dungeon. They're in a labyrinth in a thieves guild or something.
Right.
And so Damodar breaks up the thieves guild after Ridley gets the gem. He kidnaps Marina.
Mm-hmm.
And but the
she's a girl.
Thieves escape with the map and the gem, and they run into Norda, an elf played by Kristen Wilson, who works for the Empress, and is basically just your typical, you know, stoic elven badass kind of character.
She's a tracker, and she's been following them.
She doesn't actually really do all that much.
No, she just kind of shows up and yells at them.
But she helps them get to this castle where Damodar is keeping Marina. It's just like base of operations. And they sneak in. They split up. Snails is going to go look for... They got the map, didn't they? Yeah. He's got to get the map back.
Yes.
And we're also going to try to save Marina. And so they go in there. Damodar catches Snails. And long story short, like, he kills Snails.
Which is like really upsetting.
This entire movie. And I remember that Marlon Wayans was in this. And when you hear Marlon Wayans now, your eyes roll so hard. You have to watch the movie on your back. And he's the funniest part of this.
He really is.
Because the script's terrible.
It's awful.
And I don't know if his lines are written or if it's just, well, let me do a couple passes here. Just let me say what comes to my mind.
Right.
And I mean, he's, you know, a comedian. So yes, he can think of funny things to say and ways to undercut what's going on in the film.
Yes.
That just sells. They made a decision early on. We don't care. There's no concessions to this being some ancient world. Guys are going to fist bump and they're going to go, "Oh no!"
Right.
When somebody like zings somebody else, they're doing the dozens or something like that. Like, they're not going to act like the Ren Faire at all.
No, and that's okay. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I was so upset when he died. I was like, I really wish Snails was back.
They killed the dog.
They totally did.
This movie kills the dog. This is a fun, light adventure about Dungeons and Dragons, and they just kill like the only they kill the comedy character.
Yeah. They fridge Snails and
don't abuse fridging. I'm gonna get Gail Simone in here and she's gonna tell you what it's all about.
But I mean, it does totally enrage Ridley and everything. But then the ending.
Well,
I don't want to skip to the end. But that was really frustrating.
And so Ridley is mad about that. Of course, we get a great classic movie. No.
Yes. Yes.
He gets his ass kicked too by Damodar, and they barely escape with their lives. And they go to Lorien.
Mm-hmm.
No, not really. But isn't reminiscent of that. It's like late in the second act. The heroes have had their asses kicked.
Yes.
So they go to like magic elf tree.
Yes.
House. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And they get healed.
Lord of the Rings was around before this was.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, sort of references to things. Actually, ironically, guess what comes out the next year? 2001. Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Okay.
So anyway, yeah, and Tom Baker heals him.
I know.
Tom Baker is in this for some reason.
For a very small part.
Yes. It's an important part, though, because it explains something that is part of their world building that they do so little of, is that dragons are essential to this world. Like, they are the embodiment of magic, sort of. You could have this magic, you could do all this stuff because of the presence of the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And if the dragons die or are controlled, like Profion wants to do, magic will leave the world.
Right.
Of course, in Tolkien, that's just something that happens and there's nothing we can do about it. Like, it is the way of magic to sort of die out.
Mm-hmm.
But in this, it's the idea is you guys are fighting to avenge Snails and to keep the Empire together. And so non-mages will get the same rights as mages, but you're also sort of protecting our world as we know it. And it's all its
keeping
wonder.
The magic in
yeah.
it. Yeah.
So they figure out that they're going to get this rod first. They've got the stone. They've got the map. They're going to beat these guys to it. And so they go do it. Long story short, yeah, Ridley gets the dragon rod, which he could feel is very powerful. He can control dragons. It's supposed to be very scary. The movie does everything it can to make you feel how scary this is.
Right.
And it doesn't really feel very scary. And like in classic, Damodar's watched some movies before because Ridley comes out and
he's got great movie timing.
Right. He's seen Indiana Jones. He's seen a million of these movies where just let the good guy get the thing and then we'll take it from him.
Yeah.
And that's their plan. They do take it. He gives it. There's a battle. Like, I don't know. Anyway, they fight. Damodar takes the staff to Profion, who is locked in this magical combat with the Empress.
Right.
Who has gotten fed up. She's gotten her army of gold dragons to attack. Now Profion has the staff that allows him to control red dragons.
Yep.
They have a big fight.
So, like, the red dragons and the gold dragons are, like, fighting each other.
Yeah. And this fight looks like a top-notch full-motion video sequence from a 1996 CD-ROM game.
Yeah.
It does. It is not great.
No.
You have to forgive the effects because of the time, but some of these effects, even for the time, could have been better.
Yeah. I mean, you think about this film came out in 2000.
Yeah, The Matrix came out in 1999.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how can these vary so much from each other? But it's like... I don't know if maybe The Matrix had more of a budget, or I don't know, maybe they blew a lot of their budget like filming in Prague, but
well, The Matrix certainly had a bigger budget. Yeah. No, you don't blow the budget. You film a movie in Prague to save money.
Well, okay.
Yeah, that's they could do the CGI because of that.
All right.
But I didn't, except for sometimes you see things that in like a cheap movie or a movie you know they ran out of money, where it's clear that they just went, oh, let's just do that. Something, the wall wobbles because a character is thrown against it or something like that.
Right.
Keep it in, we don't have any choice. There wasn't too much of that. I feel like they didn't have as much money probably as they wanted to, but I feel like they spent it mostly well.
There isn't
anything that really looks unfinished. The one thing that I could say, and we were 2 seconds from ending the synopsis, but we'll just keep going here, is that there's the thing that sort of starts the quest, or at least gives them more information about the quest. They find this map.
Yes.
And Ridley and Marina find a way to like get sucked into the map,
mm-hmm.
where they talk to a goal or something.
I have no idea.
Who gives them their what the quest is going to be.
But we don't
know
see
why
that
we don't
at
know.
All.
They don't show that scene.
No.
That scene does not exist in this film.
Mm-mm.
So it was clear at that point, they're like, maybe they can just come back and tell us what happened, and then
right.
just save $2 million right there.
Right.
So, yeah, anyway. Ridley follows Damodar back to the tower where Profion is fighting Savina. This all sounds really great when you just describe it.
Right.
It's not that great.
No.
And they have a fight. He defeats him. Savina eventually defeats Profion by having a dragon eat him. And the whole group
yes.
learns that they got to work together, and love is stronger than hate, and chocolate ice cream is delicious.
Yep.
Even when it melts together with the vanilla.
Okay.
And you got ice cream soup. And then, completely inexplicably, at the end of the film, they go to see Snails' grave.
Yes.
Which doesn't even have a headstone. It's got a bunch of rocks piled up on it. Real classy.
Yeah, but Ridley has a brand new spanking outfit.
Yeah, well, we know where that money went.
Yeah.
And we get some kind of indication that he's not dead, or he's
Ridley,
a benevolent spirit.
Ridley gives him the stone, the ruby stone.
Right.
And
it starts glowing
on
his grave.
And then the snail's engraved rock, like the snail's thing disappears. And then the elf chick is like, do not question your gift. Your friend Snails is alive. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, he's waiting for you.
And then we don't see him at all. And the movie just ends. It isn't completely unsatisfactory. And it's like,
yes.
Wait, what happened? You didn't explain anything. What just happened here?
As much as me and my friends talked about this film, and we mostly just tried to forget it because it was not good.
It was bad.
We had a lot of theories about what was going on.
Okay.
Because there was kind of a precedent in earlier editions for like characters to possibly become deities. There were like god rules. Usually when a character reaches a certain level, you know, level 36 or something like that, you're clearly just, you are the most powerful person on this plane. Why aren't you a demigod?
Right.
You know, and always in D&D, even to this day, there has been a shifting like in between the gods. There's this intrigue that goes on with the god characters, because when you're going to call on Mystra for power to cast a spell or something, she's a real thing.
Right.
You know, she's a person too.
Mm-hmm.
She's just a person who is a god or a goddess.
Right.
And so we thought maybe Snails like became
like
a
deity. Okay.
And so they're going to go meet him. The best theory I've heard, and it's a kind of wild one that I don't think is true, is that they're all players.
Okay.
Like we are watching somebody's campaign.
Okay.
And so they are, them disappearing is just them like getting up from the table to eat pizza or something like that.
Okay.
Now, if this movie had had a Princess Bride-esque sort of thing where we keep cutting out of it,
and we saw the characters playing,
wouldn't that have been fun?
That would have been fun.
And that would remind me of like The Fall, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
In The Fall, you've got Lee Pace is like the bandit or whatever, and he's in
right.
this weird, wonderful world, but it's just a story that he's telling. And then we pull out to the mundane, you know, Mexican hospital where
right.
he's laying there with a broken back. That's too much. That's too much thought. They didn't put that much thought in,
no,
right?
No, but it would have been great, and it kind of reminds me of the Dungeons and Dragons community episode. I mean,
yeah, because otherwise we don't care about these people at all.
No, no,
I don't care about any of these people.
No, and honestly, I cared the most about Snails because he was funny.
Yeah,
and he was entertaining.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed watching him.
Kind of.
Well, he was the most entertaining thing in the movie.
He was
most
another guy who
entertaining character.
Yes, and he was stuck with this. He's by now he's been in so many bad movies
that
he's been responsible for that, you know, you can barely remember that he was lightly entertaining in this film.
Right.
But he is definitely somebody who is stuck, you know, with this bad role in this bad film, and he's doing everything he can to make it enjoyable and fun.
Yeah. And I think he, you know, really did a great job. I didn't think I would necessarily say that. I didn't think I would be here saying today Marlon Wayans
Thumbs
is the
up.
Best part of Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, Jeremy Irons, but yeah.
Well, yes. But I gotta say, I don't, okay, maybe it's because she's more or less a contemporary of mine, but Thora Birch, I feel like I've seen her in a lot of films. I feel like
Have
I
you?
Thought she was
I'm
a,
trying to think of what I've seen her in.
Well, I feel like I thought she was a better actress than is. And she's absolutely terrible.
She's very bad.
And she's got such a baby face in this too, which just makes me think, God, she's
Well, she's still got a baby
face.
She's 35, she's got a baby face.
Well, she was in Hocus Pocus. She's also in Ghost World. There was this movie, Now and Then, which was a huge teen film when I was growing up, and she was in that. Just a few that I remember seeing her in. So, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I remember her being better. So it makes me question my younger self's judgment a little bit.
Well,
but
I question you as well. Well, I think that she would have done better or could have done better if she had had better directing.
Yeah.
And that all comes down to a guy named Courtney Solomon.
Okay.
He was the director of this. I remember back when this came out, the internet wasn't quite what it is now.
Sure.
You had to be really deep into the altnets to hear the kind of information that you can just get on Variety.com.
Right.
Makes our job so easy. But I remember the stories going around back then about, okay, so this guy, like, he's been trying to get this movie made for a long time, and it's really important to him. And so we thought, okay, guy's got a love for the work. Let's give it a chance.
Right.
No. Courtney Solomon is now currently the producer and I think just the owner, like, runner of what's called After Dark.
Okay.
After Dark Films. What kind of movies do they make? They make...
Horror movies?
Yeah. But also just direct-to-video everything. Like, they are a modern B-movie studio. Every once in a while, they do something that gets a little press or notoriety, like Stallone doing Bullet to the Head with them.
Okay.
They did a movie with Ethan Hawke and Selena Gomez in 2013 called Getaway, which is like a car chase movie.
Okay.
But mostly it is not quite Asylum-level, like, rip-offs of other stuff, but it is these low-budget, gory thrillers, you know, the kind of things that you just direct-to-video type stuff. Like,
yeah, okay.
He's a huckster, right? I mean, he might even appreciate that sort of,
You think so?
Epithet. I don't know. Maybe not. But anyway, yeah, he got this made in 2000. He was 30 years old. And I found this actually really, it's hard to find information about him, about this movie, period, on the internet. But I found a fun story about him from a Jewish magazine.
Okay.
From 2000, before the movie came out.
Okay.
Interviewing him because he's from, it's from Toronto. He's from Toronto and he's a Jew. And so it talked about, like, his roots, how he got the thing, and he grew up playing lots of D&D with his friends.
Of course he did.
You know, in the back room of bar mitzvahs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so he basically thought, I want to be a filmmaker. His mother, I think, was in production. She was involved in film somehow.
Okay.
And he thought, screw it, I've got an in. I don't need to go to film school.
Uh-huh.
First mistake. And so he loved D&D, and he thought, there should be a D&D movie. This should be a franchise. Why doesn't this exist?
Sure.
So he basically, like, finagled and, like, schemed his way into, like, a pitch meeting with the people at Wizards of the Coast.
Okay.
And laid it out for them, and they basically realized, just talking to him, that he was not a movie professional. This is a 20-year-old kid who has no business being there, and just threw him out.
Okay.
But then over the course of several years, he kind of wore them down, and eventually they got Joel Silver attached to it. Joel Silver, the king of Hollywood producers.
Sure.
So he was on board, and it just kind of went from there.
Right.
And supposedly he never wanted to direct it himself. Like, he wants to direct. He's directed a ton of films now.
Right.
But even at the time, he thought, I'm not a director. We should get somebody else. I'm happy to be the producer.
Right.
And it just came down to, he calls it interference from investors and just the license holders, you know, wizards. But he eventually had to direct it, basically.
Okay.
And so, yeah, he got stuck directing it. He directed it to a $10 million loss. And you think, well, that's the end of Courtney Solomon. But I got to tell you.
Right.
This is the positive side of the hucksterism. He is still going today.
Yeah, he is.
And there is talks. There are rumors. Not even rumors. They are actively working towards a new Dungeons & Dragons film.
I've heard about that.
Which will be produced, or at least co-produced, by Courtney Solomon.
Oh, wow.
They have selected YA actor Ansel Elgort.
I from saw
the
that
Divergent
as well.
Movies,
yep.
To play the lead. It's being written by David Leslie Johnson, who wrote he's going to write Aquaman. He's writing Aquaman.
Sure.
And he wrote the Wrath of the Titans film. And then Rob Letterman is going to direct it, who, I don't know, he directed like a couple animated features. He did the Goosebumps movie.
Okay.
So, you know, this is a real movie, or at least it is more real than it was 16 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fingers crossed that
it's not going to be any good.
You don't think so?
No, of course not.
Is it naive of me to want a good Dungeons and Dragons movie? I mean, is this like
that's,
we were
that's
talking
a good question.
About earlier?
Yes, and thank you. Wow, you are a talented broadcaster. You brought it right back.
I did.
But you didn't let me finish the last bit of news I had about
it. Okay, go ahead.
Ain't It Cool says that they have got their hands on an early version of the script. I think we can probably believe them. Why not? That wouldn't be too tough to smuggle out under
sure.
your blazer. They say that the story is going to be like a Object Quest like campaign, basically.
Sure.
Which makes sense because that's... In fact, I've heard rumblings like the producers say like, oh, we want this to have like a Guardians of the Galaxy feel. Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
I have my own theory about that. Let me finish this story here. They say that the working title is Dungeons & Dragons, The Hand of Chaos.
Okay.
And Ansel Elgort's character will be named Raven Hightower, which is only slightly less weird than Ansel Elgort, as far as names go. So here's my theory, and I am not blaming James Gunn for anything. Just like the Lorien reference I made before, I think there are certain elements that you see repeated in the way that human beings tell stories.
Sure.
But I think that this movie is almost beat for beat the same story as Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
You have a
how so?
Plucky hero
uh-huh.
who considers himself an antisocial rebel.
Yep.
He steals an important item.
Yep.
He is accompanied by... Well, first of all, he's accompanied by a character who is named after an animal.
Yep.
This is the stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Who's kind of the joke character. Could be a snail. Could be a raccoon.
Yep.
They are joined on their quest by a sanctimonious woman of higher status who regards them as being less than her
mm-hmm.
and learns eventually to appreciate their talents and their company.
Mm-hmm.
They are pursued by a crazy bad guy
yep.
who is working for a crazier bad guy.
Yes.
Right? They have a showdown with him that's, you know, just like anything else. It's a showdown. There are dragons flying in one. There are ships flying in another. There's an object of power
yep.
that is corrupting. And that is made very clear in both stories that you can have this thing, but it is going to consume you.
Right.
Either literally or spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character has to wield it to save the day, but then also reject its power.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong.
And a character makes a sacrifice to save everyone.
Yes. I mean, you were not wrong, but
who's Nebula?
Nobody's Nebula.
The Tivlier or whatever, the collector is kind of the Thieves Guild guy?
Kind of.
Cuz they go to get the orb from
yeah.
that guy?
Mhm. Yeah, that's true.
Come on.
I see your points.
Just cuz you don't like it doesn't mean it's not.
I don't like it. Okay. I don't like it at all. I think Guardians is a much better film.
Well, yeah, but that's not. I'm not saying that one is better.
But
than
it
the other.
Does have a lot of similar beats and characters. It's interesting that you. So I've never really thought of Gamora as thinking of herself as higher class ranking than Quill and Rocket and Groot, but I suppose she does, even though she's technically kind of quote unquote evil in the beginning.
Right.
So there's that.
But Thanos' entire crew is elitist.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all pulling rank on each other.
Yes.
And then they are all, like, denigrating and, like, putting down the people they meet, you know, and you're filthy and you're below us. And
that's
their
true.
Boss, Ronan, wants to destroy, you know, what he considers to be a mongrel people. And
yep.
So.
That's very, very true. Mm. Okay.
Let's talk about it. What, I don't know. What would you want to see? I mean, you're not very familiar with... I'm really interested in your opinion because you're not very familiar with a lot of the created worlds, you know, the Dark Suns, the what have yous of
sure.
D&D.
Ravenlofts.
The Ravenlofts, if you will, sure. Ooh, you know, Ravenloft could be...
I think that could really
but
work.
But here's the problem. It's completely self-reflexive, looking up its own ass, because Ravenloft exists because of Bela Lugosi movies.
Yeah, I know.
It is a commentary... And an expansion
yes.
of Bela Lugosi movies. So if you make a movie based off of Ravenloft, which is based off of Bela Lugosi movies, which is itself based off of Bram Stoker books.
Yes.
Where do you end up?
I don't know. Vampires.
You're so far up your own ass, you're boxing your uvula.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, pretty much. Vampires. You're clawing at your own coffin.
Sparkle or no sparkle?
I don't know. No sparkle.
Hold the sparkle.
Hold the sparkle, please. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I really like your idea, though, about showing people playing a game and then showing them playing their characters within the setting and then going back to that and being a framing story.
Yeah. And I don't think that that's...
I don't think it has to be like that.
Necessarily necessary. But,
I also don't think...
The way that... Speaking of being up your own ass, the way that so many like Hollywood writers and producers are these days, you think they jump at the chance to add like a meta-textual element?
Mm-hmm. I don't think... I know with this movie, they're like, ooh, Dungeons and Dragons. We have to have dungeons, and we have to have dragons.
And to be fair, the first 90 seconds of the film, we get a dragon trapped inside a dungeon.
This is true.
They give you exactly what's on the tin.
They do.
That's the title is the first stumbling block I can think of.
Yeah.
You try to explain to an executive, here it is. Give him the whole pitch. 10 minutes later, he's like, so what dungeon is the dragon in?
Yeah, I know, right?
That's just the name of the game. It doesn't matter. So why do we call it, like, give me that rod? like, right?
Right.
Like, why is it Dungeons & Dragons? Well, because that's you understand brand identity, right?
Right.
That is the brand identity. You want people to come see this and understand.
Right.
Wouldn't it be great if you could tell everybody right away what Prometheus is? It's not called Prometheus. It's just called The Next Alien One.
Right.
Now, I know we can't name a movie that, but... Right. In this case, we can name a movie that. It's literally Dungeons and Dragons. You know exactly what it is.
Do you think that it would have been better to have it be called something else and then do like a colon, a Dungeons and Dragons tale or something like that?
Maybe. There are two direct-to-TV sequels.
Mm-hmm.
One is called The Wrath of the Dragon God, I believe?
Okay.
And the third one is called The Book of Vile Darkness, which is actually a reference to... a specific like book or module in D&D.
Okay.
I don't think that one's very good. I think it's got Richard Grieco in it.
Okay.
But the second one is not bad. I've seen the second one. I used to own it.
Uh-huh.
It's okay. It is like a really, really good episode of Xena. Like,
okay.
You know what I mean? Like it's... Doesn't not say it's welcome. There aren't really any stars in it. The Damodar character does actually return in the second one.
Okay.
And it is much more like an actual... D&D thing. I've heard it described that the first movie was for cinematic audiences, you know, was
yes.
for general audiences. The second film was for D&D fans.
Okay.
Because they feature four or five characters who have specific classes that are recognizable from the game.
Yep.
They go on a quest. They disarm traps while fighting monsters and looking for treasure and stuff like that. And it's kind of cool. It reminds me a lot of Conan the Destroyer.
Okay.
It's a very different film than the first film.
Mm-hmm.
It is sort of a, you can call it like a, you know, medieval buddy movie.
Right.
But it really is like a D&D campaign. Like Conan goes out, he collects, you know, a barbarian. Well, he is a barbarian, but a different one. A thief, you know, like a wizard.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a party that goes to defeat like this evil creature guy.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. And I mean, I kind of wish that this movie had been more like that. I also feel like I don't think that you need to have Dungeons and Dragons in a Dungeons and Dragons film. Let me be more specific. I don't think you need to have dragons. I think you can have plenty of dungeon crawls. Maybe you have a dragon in one part, but you don't need to make it all about the dragons, because how many times have you actually fought dragons in Dungeons and Dragons?
You don't do it all the time.
No.
But it's good, though, because there is a certain frisson when you do get to actually do it.
Yeah.
It's exciting to fight a dragon.
Absolutely. But I think that should be used sparingly and not be a huge part of the movie. But that's just my opinion.
I don't disagree. Would you recommend this film?
I would not recommend this film. I have to say, I think that I would... I don't think it deserves all the ire that it got from critics.
That's a great point.
It's more watchable.
When I sit and think about
it,
and this is, people are not even going to believe their ears, but I would probably watch this before I watched Willow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's more watchable than the rating on Rotten Tomatoes would make you think.
Yeah.
That being said, you don't need to waste your time watching this film.
I've heard it described by, I think it was by Nostalgia Critic on YouTube, that it's one of those films where there were so many choices, there were a lot of choices to make, and they made every single choice wrong. Every one.
Yeah, I think
but
that's
somehow,
a good way
when you start
it.
To get on a roll and you have made every, you've taken every wrong turn, the journey can get really interesting and sometimes entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think that that's it. That being said, boy, if we got to go binary, I would say that I don't recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
If I could just leave like a neutral recommendation, like I'm not going to say see it, I'm not going to say avoid it like the plague, but if it floats into your field of vision,
sure,
watch it.
Okay.
But if I have to tell you one way or the other, I would say you don't have to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
But there are parts that are certainly entertaining.
Absolutely.
Like that Zoe McClellan.
Yeah.
She's good looking. She's right up my alley. The 90s, she's got that crushed velvet blouse, you know. And
oh my gosh, I know.
She got a choker on at one point.
Yep. Just hitting all the bells and whistles.
I can hear Soundgarden playing in the background.
Oh, boy.
Takes me back.
Oh, boy.
I wish I could take that back. let's talk about The Dungeon Masters, a documentary from 2008, which focuses on the lives of three separate role-playing game players.
Mm-hmm.
As we said, it opens up at Gen Con. And I'm all messed up now. I don't know what year it is. I think it was like 2006.
I think so. That's what I want to say. And then runs to Gen Con 2007. So over a year.
Yeah. And it's very it's very specifically set in a certain point in time. Because a lot of it, one of the characters lives in Mississippi.
One of the people, since it's a documentary, right?
Well, she's a character as well.
Well, yes, this is true.
she lives in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
And we deal specifically with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, in the summer of 2005. So that puts us right kind of in that area. Yeah. And from what I understand, it was originally, it's directed by Kevin McAllister. He spells his name. I won't spell it now. I'll just look it up. But here's how he spells his name. So it doesn't look like the Home Alone character.
Yes.
I bet his birth certificate does not say that.
Probably not.
But anyway, poor guy. And apparently it was originally envisioned to be a history of D&D.
Right.
To possibly talk to, Gygax was alive back then.
Okay, sure.
You know, Arneson, maybe talk about its roots as a wargaming and becoming something like Chainmail and the whole crew in Lake Geneva and just coming out to being this thing. Now, of course, you talk to wizards and you talk to the people now. And it didn't end up going that way. They shifted the focus to the lives of the players, I think, very early on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that because you couldn't, as a documentary filmmaker, you wouldn't be able to survive, that script couldn't survive first contact with the people that you're going to focus on?
I don't know.
There were so many minutes in this movie where I turned to you and I was like, documentary filmmaking!
Yeah, I know.
This is how it goes. This is it.
I know.
Because they would ask a character a question, and these poor people, we're going to talk about them in a second, but there is like a high level of sort of self-delusion in a lot of their lives.
Yes.
And so a character would be like, yeah, I think this is going to turn out okay. Okay, if this was a news story or something or an interview, the character made his point, done, cut to the next thing.
Right.
No, the camera keeps rolling for 12 seconds.
I know.
And we watch them roll around what they just said in their own head. And we watch the fear of failure and impending death creep into the back of their eyes And then we cut.
I know.
And that is how you make a documentary.
I know. And it's so terrible, but yeah. It's so great.
Well, it is. It is literal human drama.
Yes.
It focuses on three people. Scott Corum, mm-hmm. who is a... and his day job is apartment manager, mm-hmm. An odd job guy, and he is a game master, but he is also a aspiring writer, and he is a puppeteer as well. Yes. He's a Christian puppeteer, and he ends up, over the course of the story, producing and starring in a cable access show as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also focuses on Elizabeth Reisman, who is a 23-year-old... She talks about getting a job or wanting a job, so I'm not sure that she is employed.
By the end of the film.
By the end, she gets a job. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, spoilers. Wow. But her main claim to fame is that she is very obsessed with dressing up.
And LARPing.
For these things. Yeah, she's a LARPer, which you asked me when this thing started. Like, is this about LARPing? And I was like, just wait for it.
Because I wasn't sure.
They talk about LARPing.
Yeah.
But it would be easy, again... Here's another tip for documentary filmmakers. Once you find your story, stick with it. Because
mm-hmm.
once they met the LARPers, it would have been easy to go, put it down, put everything down, set up the cameras,
right.
We're here for 2 weeks.
Right.
But they just show that as kind of a side aspect
right.
of role-playing in general. But she loves dressing up as a drow.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also, as we begin to learn over the course of the documentary, has had a brutal life in her short 23 years.
Yeah.
So we get into that. And then also Richard Meeks, who is a game master extraordinaire. He's a very interesting individual.
Yes, he is.
He has been game mastering for a long time. He has made and probably lost friends over it. In fact, he's definitely lost friends over it.
Yep.
In the meantime, he is a convert to Judaism.
Uh-huh.
He is a reservist in the Air Force.
Yep.
And he has a mixed-raced stepson that lives in Florida.
Yep. Yep.
He's got it all.
Uh-huh. And I think he works as an environmental...
He works for the King County. He lives in Seattle, Washington.
Yeah. So, and apparently also a nudist. So...
Oh, I buried the lead.
Yeah, you did.
And so, yeah, it was a selection, this film, for South by Southwest, and it was screened at the AFI Dallas Film Festival. And it came out on DVD in 2010. If you want to watch this film, we should mention, Dungeons & Dragons... Good luck finding it. It's out there.
It's not easy to find.
You might not be able to stream it. I know you could buy it.
For like
you probably don't want to buy it.
Yeah.
So this you could find. This streams on Hulu, although I think you need to have an account on Hulu to watch it. But you can find this around the Dungeon Masters. A lot of people don't like it. It did not receive, because I don't believe it was released theatrically. It was released on DVD.
Okay.
There aren't enough critic responses to give it a rating
critic
on
response?
Rotten Tomatoes.
But doesn't it have like a
well,
audience
there's
rating?
An audience meter and there's a critics meter.
Yes.
There are four critics reviews. 3 out of 4 of them are fresh.
Okay.
But the audience reviews, there are a couple, and it's got 20% from audiences.
It's not good at all.
No. I don't care what, I don't ever care what an audience thinks really about a film. But I can see how people who play games and whose lives are maybe like these people's would be uncomfortable with this picture of that.
I agree with you on
I
that.
Could also see how I'm not going to call it boring, but I'm going to call it contemplative.
Mm-hmm.
You are watching people who are trying to escape from their kind of semi-boring, possibly, you know, well, their normal if not boring lives.
Right.
You're watching those lives.
Yes.
It's not like there's a lot of drama.
No.
Somebody doesn't get hit by lightning and then we got to go deal with that.
No.
Although they do live in Hurricane Katrina. So I can also see why people who are not seasoned film watchers would not like that either.
Right.
If you had to give it a rating, what would you give it?
I mean, are we talking letter or star?
I'm not putting anything on you.
Or numbers?
You pick the rating.
I actually would give it like 4 out of 5 stars or maybe like a solid B like rating. I actually really enjoyed the film. I feel like it showed some views on Dungeons & Dragons that you don't often get to see. Not all positive, but I think some of them were positive. And
yeah.
I think that they chose interesting people to follow.
Yeah, I would give it a B.
Yeah.
Because the one part, and this doesn't even have to be there, because this quickly becomes like a slice of life documentary.
Yes.
But their premise falls apart real fast because we meet all these characters because of their association with role-playing in Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes.
But for a guy like Scott, his story has nothing to do with him playing D&D. Like, we see him playing D&D at the Gen Con,
yeah.
and then there's no more D&D.
Yeah.
And it becomes about him.
There's other fantasy
writing
elements
this book
and stuff.
And trying to get this book made and how that plays out. I don't have a book agent. I know that there are tiers of book agents.
Yes.
And he got the worst.
Yeah, he did.
Like, that woman didn't help him at all.
Yeah.
And it's clear that he is somewhat deluded as to what he's going to be able to sell as a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he needs an agent that's going to be real honest with him about that. But she's just super negative. And then she tells him, yeah, I don't think this is really that great, but she takes it to the upper higher ups, and they're like, oh, that looks pretty good. You know, get him to clean it up a little and then, you know, send it back to us. And she goes back to him and she's like, I don't like this. I don't understand it. But they thought it was great. And at that point you go, okay, great. Can you hand me that phone book? Yeah, can you just turn to A for agents?
Yeah.
I'll just tear that page out and give it
to
me.
Yeah.
Why stick with this person?
I know.
His naivety is kind of like his big flaw. Like, it gets him in trouble.
He's very trusting.
Because he keeps expecting that things are going to turn out.
Yes.
And they aren't really.
He puts his faith in some people who maybe he shouldn't put his faith in.
Yeah, and so. It's not like he's not working. It's just he seems to lack. Well, I mean, I'm a nerd. I know a lot of nerds. I've seen this. He lacks, you could possibly call it common sense or maybe horse sense. But he just lacks like an awareness of what's really going to happen here. It seems like, and here's the pull quote, you know, the tagline, he lives in a fantasy world.
Right.
There are some harsh realities here. It is going to be tough to move this book.
Yeah.
You might get an agent who doesn't believe in you, is not going to support you. You might have black mold all over those boxes in your tiny apartment.
Yes.
But he just keeps kind of going, well, we'll see how it works. And he sort of has a very, you know, he's sort of telling the story of his life, this drama.
Right.
But if he would edit the story a little bit, maybe his life would be better. Like, think ahead to some stuff. Shop the book around.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's having problems. They start making this show, this yes. Cable access show, which God knows if that really went anywhere. But
I have some news on that.
Oh, okay. We'll get to that in a sec. And he's having some issues mm-hmm. with some of the other people in it because I guess it's just drama. You know, it's just drama yes. in between people from some other people who are also not thinking about what it is that they are sabotaging, you know,
right.
by not just being honest about stuff and being adult about stuff. And so one of the things that I think that you could level at this documentary, or going into it without having seen it, what you could expect to be is
right.
you're going to show us that these are all just a bunch of like idiot man children, right?
Right.
And I'd say this documentary does a pretty good job of, if not dispelling that, at least giving you reasons for it.
Right.
And I think that he does act in that way. And you can kind of understand why, but he kind of gets in his own way.
He does kind of get in his own way. I read an article with him recently. He has his own YouTube channel.
Oh, good.
Where you can see the first episode of the...
Oh, okay.
They started...
You made it sound like he was...
I know. he was asked by the interviewer if there was going to be any more, and he said that... They filmed parts of the second episode at the cable access company, but unfortunately they were lost.
Huh.
But there's talk of maybe getting back together at some point in the future and doing more.
Okay, so it sounds like nothing really.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's lost. I mean, stuff certainly can happen. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But somebody who is not paying attention and like taking things seriously.
Right.
It seems like things like that happen to people like that more often.
Right.
And I think that his problem is just his head is not screwed on totally straight in terms of what he needs to focus on and if he's serious. And I've gone through this myself, just trying to create and trying to do something like this podcast. Like, you got to take it seriously.
Yeah, and you absolutely do.
And and you can't just expect, it's all going to work out.
Right. So, I mean, you can... If you're interested, you can just Google him and be able to find his YouTube page and kind of check that out.
Scott, Corum.
Yes.
And let's talk about Elizabeth Reisman.
Yes.
Who, the drow girl.
Yes.
Who dresses up like a drow. If you don't know, a drow is a dark elf.
Mm-hmm.
They have completely black skin.
Yes.
Movie never once even tries to address this woman blacking up.
Nope.
Do you know what I mean?
Nope. They just show you.
And
to
I think
her,
it's fine.
And I think that's okay.
Well, she's walking around in Mississippi, you know, with black makeup on her face.
I know.
But it is so weird and alien that it's clear that she's not doing a thing. You know
no.
What I mean?
And to be clear, too, this is black as like black.
Black, black.
Yeah. Like this is
she shows her recipe for her makeup.
Yes.
And it's like black mixed with purple and like silver.
And some blue.
Yeah, yeah. To give it this real deep obsidian hue.
Kind of metallic. And she said it took her a couple of years to come up with the right formula.
Yeah.
And
so we see her doing that. We see her also playing role-playing games. Also, we see her LARP.
Yes.
And this is one of the things that I remember clearly from this film. Because the other two guys, they're fine. They're family men. Their families love them. They play role-playing games sometimes. They're kind of jerk off sometimes, fine.
Right.
But I remember her working at the LARP.
Yes.
And not only is she a character in this LARP, but she is, I can't remember what they call it now, but she's like a monster wrangler.
Something like that.
She's a narrative designer, basically.
Yeah.
When you LARP, you go out in your costume, you've got your foam sword or your birdseed bag spells and things like
that. Right.
And you fight each other. There's storylines and stuff. When you get killed, you leave the playing field. You're dead.
Mm-hmm.
But usually you get sent back into the playing field to play a monster.
Sure.
You are a jaguar,
uh-huh.
But a skeletal one.
Right.
That's something that she says in the movie.
Yes.
And she's got like this list of things, and it's clear that people come to her, and we see this girl at the beginning of the movie in black makeup and a white wig, looking unsure of herself in a hotel room, talking to a camera crew. Later on, she is in charge of that table.
Oh, she
and people
totally
are coming
is.
To her. She's telling them what to do. They are deferring to her. They interview her coworkers or just friends, co-players. They have nothing but good stuff to say about her and her organizational skills. And I'm like, this girl can't find a job? Come on.
Yeah.
Like, this is something that she is clearly good at. She is so talented at. And I know so many nerds who don't know that they that thing that they have done every weekend of their life and they love and they are good at and facile at, they have no idea that those things are things that you can do.
Right.
Even if it isn't working in the game industry, even if it isn't designing video games or working for Wizards of the Coast or whatever.
Right.
Like, all those skills can be integrated into your current job, another job that would let you do those things. And she just hasn't figured that out. Because when she takes the makeup off and goes home, and just plays WoW, she's like, well, I hope my life works out. And again.
Yeah. I know.
And she's had, we talked about her tragedy. She's had problems too. She was married at like 18 or 19.
Very young.
To a very abusive man. And got out of that situation and seems to just be resigned to this fate of having bad, you know, weird boyfriends who care more about, you know, WoW or World of Warcraft computer games and stuff than her. And so she's having trouble connecting. Over the course of the documentary, she meets a guy who moves in with her, and it seems like everything's going to go okay. And then we get to the end of the documentary, the last chapter, and it's broken up into five chapters, like sort of like a book or a play. And she's with somebody else. And in a reveal that should have been on an episode of The Office.
Yes.
She's talking. She's in her costume again. It's a year later at the next Gen Con. And she's like, well, Sam and I broke up or whatever, but I have found Doug. And the camera pulls out.
And he's dressed like
and
a drow.
Yes, he's in the exact same makeup as her.
You can't plan that.
No. You can if it's Dwight and
Angela or something.
Angela. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
One of my other favorite parts, though, and this is so horrible, was when she was with her former boyfriend who just moved in with her. And he was like talking about, well, I mean, I lived with the past couple people I've lived with, I was dating at the time. And as long as you're both mature, even if you like break up, it's not a big deal, you know, whatever. And she's like, yeah, I don't think that'll happen to us, though. And then he doesn't say anything and the camera keeps rolling.
Yep.
And she like looks up at him, like kind of like, what?
He's looking at his computer screen. She's looking at him.
Yeah.
For like 10 seconds.
Yeah. Yep. And then it's like, yeah, I'm not so sure about this guy either. Kind of seems like he's just using you for a place to live. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think that her story is probably my favorite part. I don't know why. There's pathos there. You know, there's a struggle. I'm rooting for her. Yeah, and I'm probably more similar to the two guys. Well, let's get to the third guy real fast. Richard Meeks.
Yes.
He is all those things we described,
mm-hmm.
and yet more. And he is a real interesting individual. You yes. find out that he lived in Florida for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I assume when he was probably in his mid-30s or late-30s.
Something like
and
that.
And he married a woman mm-hmm. who had children from a previous relationship.
Yep.
We never see her. No release got signed there. But we know that the kids are like at least mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this... This chubby white guy with a flat top and like a Hitler mustache hanging out with like this little black kid.
Yep.
And it shows there's a sequence where it shows them they're swimming together and they're like at the park and they're running around. And we find out that at some point Richard just decided that he wanted his life to be different. We don't dig much into it, but he totally demurs it in the film. But he thought, well, you know, I'm not married to this woman. Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. He's not married to this woman. And so he, they're not my kids. And so he just got on a plane,
left.
And flew to Washington or wherever, and that was it.
Which is just so upsetting.
Yeah, it's weird. And so we follow him as he goes back to Florida. The pitch of his sort of story is that he has been running this long-term game with his friends since they were kids, essentially. And he's a tough game master. He's the kind of game master that if you make one mistake, he'll kill the whole party, no problem.
Yep.
And he's done this to his friends several times. So he sets up like one last final going away game. Like we'll wrap up our character's story. And he's got to travel to Florida to do it where all his friends are.
Mm-hmm.
So do that game. And also he's going to meet up with his son-in-law, who is now probably early 20s.
Right.
Is a fireman or at least a volunteer fireman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awkward.
That is a tough scene
to watch
yep.
because it's clear that they care about each other. Richard specifically talks about how he doesn't have a lot of social skills, at least outside of the table.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't talk to this kid. The kid is just like, I just have a life that I'm trying to live and I got to deal with this.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, I mean, that's painful.
It's really painful. And Richard is like, oh, thanks for the Father's Day card. And he's like, yep, you're welcome. And then he's like, oh, I'm so glad you're not mad anymore. And then it just pans to the kid and it's like.
Keep rolling.
Yeah.
Keep rolling.
Yeah. Oh, he's totally not mad anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it is rough. It's rough. And
it's really rough.
It doesn't get much better when he plays this final game. I wish that they had kind of... The structure of the thing is fine, I think. It's that five-act structure. None of the people have, like, a real... Like I said, there's no lightning bolts. Nobody wins the lottery. Nobody dies. They all just sort of... We meet them. We learn who they are. They go through a lot of pain. There's something's
right.
pulled out. The rug's pulled out. And they get a little kind of minor victory at the end.
Right.
And... So that's fine. Maybe you could design it differently where we actually get to see some of Richard's game. Because I was interested to know
yes.
the paces that they're going to put them through. Instead, we just cut to it a couple times for color. And then it becomes clear, or at least they set this up in the editing, that the game falls apart.
Yeah.
Because he, once again,
does a TPK.
Is very strict. He's killed the entire party or whatever.
Yeah.
And he writes a letter. He goes home to Washington and writes a letter to everybody involved in the game being like, well, I'm not going to do it anymore. Because I feel like you guys don't respect what I do. And you don't take it seriously. And he expects everybody to email him back being like,
what do you mean?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Or screw you. And not a lot of people email him back.
No, because they
like,
think he's a jerk.
Huh. They didn't email me back. Okay. And that's kind of how we write out of his story.
And he's just kind of like a sad puppy about it. And it's like... You know what, though? You did it
to yourself.
But it's that
same lack of self-awareness.
Yes.
Where he just is not able to look at that. He does get, like we said, minor victory at the end because we see that no matter what's happened in the past, he's got this, his new wife or his wife period, I guess. I'm still not sure about his marital status. But anyway,
yeah.
He's with her. He's involved in their church or their temple,
their
I should
temple,
say.
Yeah.
And he seems very happy and content there. And so maybe him putting the books down, breaking the staff, if you will, is good for him.
Well, and I noticed, too, at the end of the film, we go back to Gen Con, where it all started.
Yeah.
They don't show him there. So I'm kind of thinking he wasn't there the following year.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he goes through some of the books.
Like, oh, yeah. He's got some classic old modules, too.
And he says that he's going to get rid of some of them. I don't know if he actually did or if he just put them in storage.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's
if
for
he
the
just kind of shuffled them around. Right.
Yeah.
So, but the idea that, you know, maybe he's going to put this on hold for a while.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's I don't want to bend your ear too much longer. That's pretty much it. Yeah. It's about 80 something minutes. You know, it's under 90 minutes. If you have played D&D at all in your life, I think you'd like this. I think that you will recognize a lot of people.
Yes.
In this, you'll see people you know, and I think that that is cool. If you see it, and you want to charge the filmmakers with making people look pathetic. I don't think that you are wrong necessarily, but I don't think they are doing it for the reason that you might be saying they are, which is, look at the freaks, you know, for entertainment value.
Right.
I think that they don't try to lionize these people. They don't try to hide things to make them look better. They just show you everything.
At face value.
And it turns out that these are real human beings,
yes,
you know, who are good people, but who they lack a certain self-awareness
they're
about
flawed.
Themselves.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely, and they're flawed.
Yeah.
And that is what makes them captivating.
Absolutely. So, I agree. Yeah. I would
recommend for
yes.
sure. You got to see this. Good stuff. Okay, we didn't talk about what we're going to do next time on Craft of Services.
Yes, we do.
So, I don't think we've talked about it at all. I wanted to have this November month, since it's NaNoWriMo, which is the National Novel Writing Month. You can
yes.
look it up online if you're interested. To be about storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
November
which is
why we storytelling
did Dungeons
month.
And Dragons.
Yeah, it's literally telling stories. And, of course, we talked about the Dungeon Masters as well. And so, we got to keep it in the realm of bad, quote-unquote, movies. So, we're going to watch Delirious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Delirious?
I don't.
This
think
is where
I
you
do.
Go. Oh yeah, I'm Eddie Murphy.
Oh,
in red leather. That's not what we're talking about. Although, God, I wish we could watch that for this.
No. Don't think that's a Craft of Services film.
No, and it's definitely more than 50% of Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
No, I mean the 1991 movie starring John Candy.
Okay.
It is 44% non Rotten Tomatoes. It stars John Candy as a soap opera writer. He gets essentially a Well, he gets hit in the head, not to give too much away, and he wakes up in the show that he's writing.
Okay.
And so there is I don't know if you remember the movie that came out a little while ago with Will Ferrell called Stranger Than Fiction, where Emma Thompson
yes.
is like an author writing his life.
Yes.
It becomes kind of like that. In this sort of dream world, he is able to affect what is happening because he is the writer of the sitcom.
Sure.
Or the soap opera.
Okay.
So we kind of go from there.
All right. I mean, it sounds intriguing. 44% is not that bad.
Yes. And John Candy has been in good movies and bad movies, but I think probably more good than bad, at least I'd hope, unless we do Wagons East. And so I'm glad that we were able to squeeze him in, and we have to squeeze. That's the kind of joke he would have loved.
Oh, wow.
But this is probably the best way to do it, and hopefully most entertaining, watching Delirious with John Candy from 1991 next time on Craft of Services. All right, well, I think I've taken my voice about as far as it's going to go. I don't know what's going on with me. Got to take care of the pipes.
Too many biscuit and gravy potato chips, I think.
So disgusting.
and yet
I can't stop
eating them.
You know what it really is, though? The pepper.
Okay.
You ever have like salt and pepper chips? Or I think they do like a pepper and vinegar, like a salt and vinegar.
Oh, I don't think I ever have.
Yeah, I really love pepper.
Okay.
I mean, I like all kinds of peppers, but just like what you think of as like peppercorns, like black pepper, I really like it. I like peppercorn. No, I like pepper, but I don't really like peppercorns.
Well, I mean, I don't really want to chomp on
I don't want to crunch.
No.
I don't want a meal of pepper.
No.
But I like a dusting of the flakes.
Okay.
Just enough spice talk. on our show. No, it's nerd talk. You could be nerdy for spices, though.
Sure. You could be nerdy for just about anything.
Alton Brown is like the king, nerd king of cooking.
Yeah.
He's going to have a series that's a sequel to Good Eats.
Oh, there you go.
I think it's going to be probably Netflix or something like that. So,
well, look out for that.
Yeah. Maybe we'll talk about that in the show.
Maybe.
In the future show. But we're not in the future yet. We're still in the present. So for now, in the present, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter if you want to join our social media army and let us know what you think about role-playing games. Played them? Like them? Haven't played them? Don't like them? Couldn't imagine why. Played them once. Hated it. Played it once. Want to do it again?
Mm-hmm.
Let us know at those places. You can also find us on iTunes. If you search for Just Enough Trope, you can find our show page. And I'd appreciate it if you would take the time to subscribe to the show. When you subscribe, you get that show right away on our rigid schedule. When it is ready, it comes to you, and you don't have to go hunt for it.
That's right.
That's cool. I also want to mention, say you don't like iTunes. I can't believe it. I can't believe you wouldn't like... I don't really use iTunes a lot either. As a producer, I use it, but I do find... Often getting I'm getting my shows in other places. We are available in other places.
Yes, we are.
We are available in on Spreaker, which is probably one of the most popular places to get your shows other than iTunes. So you can find us there if you want someplace other than iTunes. You can also get our show right from our site at justenoughtrope.com. But going back to iTunes, if you do find us there, give us a review because we love to hear from the fans and love to hear how you think we're doing. And while you're there, give us a rating. This is so important. When you give us a high rating, we move up in the ranks and everybody gets what they want. We can bring more things to you.
That's right.
Everybody's really happy. So give us 5 snails.
I like it.
If you replace every character in that film with a Marlon Wayans, you've got like, oh no, someone's used a clone spell.
Yes.
Or something.
It's a party of Marlon Wayans.
Has he been? Yeah, that's when everybody rolled a goofy thief. Oh, we're in trouble. Yes, he must have been in like a body swapping clone movie or something, right?
Oh gosh, I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know he was in that movie where his senses get real. What's
like
it called?
Goofy.
It's probably called I think it's called Senseless. If it's not, it but is. It's called Senseless. His senses get magnified like Daredevil, but they instead of being like, "Oh, I'm blind, so all my other senses are better."
Right.
It like he loses one of his senses.
Okay.
So he can like smell really good, but now he can't hear.
Okay.
That's not the funniest scenario that you could come up with, but
no, but I understand it.
David Spade's in it.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, look it up.
Okay.
But while you're looking it up, give us 5 stars instead, and we'd really appreciate it. That's it. We are doing Comic Book Club the next time that we are back on Friday, and we're talking about Black Science from Image Comics with Matteo Scalera, who is the most terrifying comic artist you'll ever meet.
Oh.
He is incredibly talented and turned out to be incredibly nice. But when I met him at Emerald City Comic Con, I thought my blood was going to be on the floor in 30 seconds. Turns out that, no, it's not.
No.
My wallet will be because he charges $200 for a sketch. But it's all worth it. And, of course, it's written by Rick Remender. So come back and check that out with us. In the meantime, we're going to sign off. I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.